We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from five-star app Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpis, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host today, Ariel Garten. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation and mindfulness practices have the power to change our lives. To kickstart the new year, if you haven't already, you can download the Meditation Studio app in the App Store, where you'll find over 500 meditations on everything from sleep, stress, and anxiety to happiness, motivation, confidence, and so much more, all designed to inspire you to solve the big and little challenges we face in life and to be your very best self every day. Our app is like having a little inspirational coach in your back pocket when you're facing any challenge. Today, join Yu's co-founder, neuroscientist, brainiac, and Untangle co-host Ariel Garten as she goes inside the head of her amazing guest.
Thanks, Patricia. Hello, I'm Ariel, and I'll be your guide as we go inside the head of some of the world's most extraordinary brain scientists, psychologists, meditators, those who are skilled in the mental arts. And we're going to learn both from their cutting-edge work and their own human experience, how our brains work, how to optimize them, and how to manage the crazy in all of our minds. This week, we're going to get inside the head of Dr. Shama Rahman. She's a PhD neuroscientist who studies creativity and flow. And so this week, we're going to flow inside of her brain and learn how to get creative. She's going to teach us about the neuroscience of flow and creativity and how we can spend more time in those states. So welcome, Shama. We're excited to get Thank inside you. Your head.
I hope you like what you find in there.
I'm sure. So let's just begin with defining what flow is. It's a concept that we hear a lot about. Mm-hmm. What is this thing?
I think a lot of people have heard about flow in the context of being in the zone. And some other people also think it's focus, but actually there's a distinction between focus and flow. So flow, just to give you a little bit of background, was actually coined by a Hungarian psychologist called Csikszentmihalyi Mihai. And he was investigating what are the underlying correlates or principles or processes for happiness. He's one of the sort of forefathers of like positive psychology. He was carrying on the work of Jung, who's another obviously very famous psychologist. And what he discovered was that, you know, notwithstanding the cultural differences of what I might consider to be happy or what you might consider to be happy, what seemed to be shared by people was this sort of intense, enhanced peak performance state of mind, which he then coined flow. And it has a couple of properties that are shared by everybody. So sometimes people say, okay, I completely lost track of time. You know, that seems much shorter than it was, or that seems, you know, much longer than it was. And then, you know, they'd be like completely absorbed and engaged in that task. And normally flow happens when there's a balance between your skills and the challenges that are posed to you. So for example, I'm not a marathon runner, but if you get me to run the marathon, I would most probably find that too difficult until I, you know,
no flow.
Gather the skills, no flow. I'll just be like dying on the side of the road. Right. And so that's when it kind of occurs. But then once you're in it, the sort of really interesting things that start happening, you know, one of the things is the perception of time. It's intrinsically motivating. It's intrinsically rewarding. So people actually do feel happier when they're, you know, in these states of flow. There's a sense of achievement. And cognitively speaking, people increase their mental flexibility when they're in flow. So they're very interesting, that one. Yeah, because it helps you to change strategy, makes you mentally more resilient. It's the exact opposite of stress, because in psychological terms, that's considered what they call functional fixedness, where you basically, you fixate on one sort of aspect of something. You can't really see the wood for the trees, right? With flow, you're able to be a lot more flowy about it, right? And this is what I think leads to higher states of creativity, where you're able to have lots of different concepts that don't necessarily hold together normally in your head, but you are able to look at it and go, well, why not? What are these connections? What are these sort of like associations? And on that note, and going back to the difference with focus, is that, you know, you're able to look at the little details, but you're also able to broaden out your attention from the details to include the bigger picture.
So this is amazing. Okay. So flow is a state where you are losing track of time.
Yeah.
People often describe it as being fully absorbed in something.
Mm-hmm.
And with it comes this ability to be more creative. So I guess this is where the intersection between flow and creativity comes from.
Yes. And so I was looking in my PhD, I was basically, first off, super interested in the idea of consciousness. And then everybody was like, great, do you want to have career death as you start? And I was like, wait, what does that mean? It's like, you don't become a neurophilosopher until the end, you know, when you can, you can kind of philosophize about something. And I was like, but I'm still really interested in consciousness. But okay, what about consciousness am I interested in? And for me, because my background is also a performer, I'm a musician and an actor and a storyteller, essentially. I was just like, okay, clearly I'm interested in creativity. And what I see, I think creativity is almost like a phenotype of consciousness. It's what you actually see, what you can actually look at the processes of. It doesn't...
Like it's an expression of.
It's an expression of, exactly, the features of consciousness. And I think you're utilizing all of your brain and all of your, you know, different aspects of what you are in order to be creative. I was drawing heavily on, you know, people who'd done more qualitative studies of the creative processes, you know, notably a guy called Wallace, for example, who went and interviewed like hundreds of eminent creatives. And that doesn't just mean fine artists and musicians. It also means chemists, architects, you know, and he was like, well, what's the commonality between all of your processes? And it's nice to think about it as problem solving, right? And creativity is problem solving, innovation. And so I kind of used those sort of frameworks and thought, okay, this will really help me know where to look as far as like EEG or physiology is concerned. And also looking at, say, things like computational creativity and then bringing in psychology models like flow. And so I find a signature brain pattern for when people were like performing at their peak creative, which is when they're in flow.
Huh.
That is to long-windedly answer your question.
Okay, so
your
I have
question.
To know, what is this brain signature for
peak
creativity and flow?
Yeah, it's actually a complex one, right? And so flow, by my definition, or by Csikszentmihalyi's definition, is a complex cognitive behavior. It goes beyond focus. It goes beyond, relaxation. It seems to be in a sweet spot between the two places. And my hypothesis was that it wouldn't come from one particular part of the brain. It's not modular from that perspective. And I went into this idea of connectionist theories, which is the whole of the brain is required in order to create a higher cognitive behavior, such as that. So there are multiple regions of the brain involved, and there's different activation patterns that are involved when you look at it through time. And I looked at it, obviously, yeah, EEG musicians. And I think other people looked at it using MRI studies. And mm-hmm. they looked at rappers and lyricists and poets. And similar areas are coming out. Similar activation patterns are coming out. And what it says to me is really good news because it means that it's domain in specific. It doesn't matter if you're talking or making music or whatever it is. So it's like what it's showing to me is that there's a common neuronal network. The same way you and I share the same memory systems, but you know, we access those memories differently. The memories are different, right? So that's I think flow means different things, you know, to different people. So if you are creative, flow means being really creative. You know, if you're an athlete, it means higher performance. You know, it could mean employee engagement, well-being in other areas, right?
Let's dig into that for a minute, and then we'll get back to what this common brain network is. So when you look at flow, you're quite correct in saying it is different things to different people. So when I think about when I'm most in flow, it's various points.
Yeah.
One is between like 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. That's when I've always done my best work.
Yeah.
And when nobody bothers you, you're not hungry, there's nothing to distract you. And so you're just in this zone. And I've been extraordinarily creative and like ideas feel like they're coming out of nowhere and you just want to keep making. And I could be doing something boring. You know, computationally based, boring organizing of stuff.
Yeah.
Or I could be doing something that's really engaged, making clothing or making art, you know, creating new ideas or programs or protocols. And they all contain the same sensation of being simply me and the content, and nothing else matters at that point.
So it doesn't matter if it's boring work either. You can feel a distinct difference.
Yes. Okay. And I don't perceive it as boring. It's something that I would normally see as boring that might be rote. But you do it with a sort of inspired sense, a sense of sort of inspiration. For me, it's a sense of inspiration, a sense of, you know, excitement about it, a sense of anything's possible, and you're sort of swimming with the content. So that's one flow. There's another flow that I get into that a lot of people talk about, which is on the dance floor.
Okay.
You know, you've got the music going, and you could be dancing for an hour and not realizing it.
True that.
Some people get it while they exercise. And you're just doing that thing and kind of nothing else matters. You might be having an internal dialogue going on, but it's very absorbed. Like you are absorbed in it. And then some people talk about extreme sports.
Yes, absolutely.
So to get into flow, often people do things like surfing, rock climbing, stuff that requires your 100% attention.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating that you have all of these kind of different, I guess we can use the term phenotypes, like all of these different forms of activity that somebody's taking on that look completely different. Some of them are individual, some of them are in group. People can talk about group flow too. You have like these amazing group experiences.
Yeah, co-creative sessions or like devising theater pieces together. Like it's another buzz that I love.
Yeah, so you've got all these different things, but they all seem to have some underlying set of characteristics and patterns.
Yes, exactly. And that's where I think the cognitive commonalities can help us piece together. What is it that is creating all these different manifestations, what you might call an emergent property of the sum of the parts that are interacting together? And it appears as different things to different people, but actually has these commonalities of mental flexibility, being able to look at the bigger picture at the same time as the details, being super aware of those things. And yeah, you're so absorbed, you want to do it more. That sort of thing. Yeah.
It's compelling. So what are these neural commonalities? What are the neural networks that seem to be engaged in each of these, across these various?
I mean, from what I could tell, there's about three or four different areas that come together. Some of them are related in the frontal cortex, some of them in the dorsolateral cortex, and some of them in the precuneus area. It makes sense because individually, these areas are responsible for different things. Some of it's related to attention. Some of it's related to connectivity, where they act as a hub for other parts of the brain to talk to each other. Almost, I don't know, is there a traffic analogy there somewhere? I don't know.
The traffic controller.
In some way, yeah. Yeah, rather than like what I might have been expecting, which was like, suddenly this, you know, all parts of the brain are connected to all parts in some critical mass, right? What I've been finding more was just like, actually, there are certain areas that allow connectivity faster than, say, your conscious decision-making brain might be doing. So that kind of makes sense as well, because, you know, like there's a speed of connection of concepts and thoughts, and whether it's rock climbing or dancing or being creatively in the composition of music or something like that. There's a bit of a difference. If your frontal lobe is very consciously involved in something, it tends to kind of pick something up, investigate it from all different angles and then gives you a decision as to whether it's a good idea or not. That's quite slow. Another part of the brain is related to like self-editing.
Which part of the brain is that?
So kind of related to the dorsolateral and related to the activation pattern as well. So say one's up and the other one's down and vice versa. It depends, although, for example, if I'm talking about creativity, it's not always useful to be like coming out with lots of ideas.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Sometimes it's useful to be editing them and analyzing them and going, well, is that a good idea? So there's a definite toolbox that's related to problem solving and flow as related to that. And there's lots of different stages before you get into flow. And so the enablements of flow are possibly different as well.
This is incredibly cool. We have multiple brain regions, some of which are responsible for making decisions and activating regions of the brain faster than our prefrontal cortex, which although is amazing at making decisions, it's kind of slow and clunky. So you have the sort of internal execution process that takes over when you move into flow. And depending on what you need at the moment, you can move into different kind of toolboxes in your brain.
Yeah. And there's also like an area that's related to defocused attention as well.
Let's talk about that.
So one of the stages in problem solving is right at the beginning, which is preparation. What does that mean? It literally means you're researching a lot. You have a razor sharp focus, actually, and you're trying to ingest a lot of things. You probably have a broad idea of what you're trying to look at, but really what you're doing is you're trying to define that more and more, refine it by following some hypotheses and then learning from that. But then it doesn't help to carry on being in that razor sharp attention state. You should actually put it to one side and what they call incubate, which would mean like you go for a walk, talk to your friends, make some good food, don't do another PhD in maths. You know, the point is not to tax the brain, because what it's then doing is like allowing the percolation to happen in a defocused way, allowing concepts to come together, juxtapose, hit together and kind of go, well, yeah, okay, okay. So part of that's again to do with not self-editing as you're going along and not dismissing an idea before even, you know, comes to fruition.
That's very cool. So if we were to get into flow, what are some of your recommendations?
I mean, I'm half kind of said it when it comes to problem solving, for example, creativity or whatever it is. I think a lot of people might go, oh yeah, I'm just going to be hit with that bolt of inspiration. I go to a mountain, sit under a tree and all that sort of stuff. Whilst that might be true, you also need to do the work beforehand, which is like, you know, some of this work, you know, in terms of the preparation, the research, even try out some of your ideas, like give it a go, you know, and then you need to like relax. So, you know, other researchers have looked at that particular aspect, and it turns out that the default mode network is what comes into play then. And by definition, it gives you an idea of what the default mode network is. It's what your brain is doing when you're not making it do other things, basically. Yep. And so it comes up highly in mind wandering and daydreaming. So let yourself dream, which I know is not easy, especially in like our current work situations and like what we expect of ourselves as well. And I think it's something that, you know, you need to learn how to integrate cutting yourself some slack within, you know, that entire process, because that's when then after incubation, you get into this aha, like eureka insight moment where you get that like light bulb like going off, probably in the shower.
So you cycle between the creative inspiration and then the execution,
I would say. Yeah. I mean, maybe even the inspiration of the ideas that are coming through as well. There's possibly a gateway, right? And say in brainstorming, you're like, aha, let's flow with that. You know, and then that becomes like it kind of like snowballs, and then you're like, and then maybe another idea comes with, and then it snowballs. So it doesn't always have to be in the execution, but kind of maybe the path of it, I would say. And I think you do that for a while and then you come out of it. And which I think is very important to highlight as well, is, you know, you're not meant to be in flow like 24/7.
Okay. This is an important point because people who are obsessed with flow are like, why aren't, you know, I want to be in flow right now.
Yeah. It's a very energy intensive activity. So going back to my thing about being a marathon runner or not, right? It happens in the sweet spot of when you're being stimulated just enough. Mm-hmm. But after that, it becomes stress, right? But you know, in order to even get to that sweet spot, there's a stimulation that's happening. Energy is being put into that. The fact that you can have focus and a big attention at the same time is energy intensive, right? And so I think, you know, another thing would be sleep well, you know, and after a while, you know, you will run out of that energy and it's time to kind of chill and then show yourself, your audience, your colleagues, what work you've made. And then take on that feedback and reiterate the whole thing. So it's okay to be messy. It's okay to have that uncertainty in a creative process or whatever it is and just go with it.
So if we were looking at really practical tips for how somebody would get into flow, what would you say?
Do your work in terms of prepare around the subject, then allow your brain to breathe, essentially take a break, you know, and allow yourself to do something different and allow, you know, your brain to carry on doing the work without you getting in the way. And then some people also swear by this idea of like, if you can feel the idea coming, you know, look at a piece of like white. So, you know, it doesn't clutter your visual attention or something like that. Let the idea come through and then go with it. In terms of the actual flow that then will ensue. I think also like try not to have distractions, you know, pinging phones and this, that doesn't really help.
So I look around at, you know, the employees in our office, for example, and I see people clacking away. I see this look on their face sometimes and they're working on something. They're engaged. They're doing something.
Yeah.
Is it likely that, you know, during an office day, if you're engaged in doing something and enjoying what you're doing, you are entering a state of flow at that moment?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And engagement and high meaningful engagement is definitely one of the properties of flow, for sure, for sure. And yeah, you can definitely be. That's what I'm investigating actually at this moment, is looking at flow within work.
Cool, because people often talk about flow as this super precious thing. You know, it's only when you're rock climbing or surfing or like, you know, at your best creative moment.
Yeah.
But the reality is we often probably go in and out of flow during our day.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, when you're an athlete or a dancer or a musician, you know, getting into flow is part of the training. And so that's actually what you're achieving anyway. So, you know, when you're trying to improvise or when you're trying to do this rock climbing and you're trying to do this incredible piece of dance that you're trying to execute, right? It's just that, you know, most other people who don't have that within their training may not recognize it as such, right?
Nice.
And people have definitely been in flow. Maybe it's transient. Maybe they don't realize that it's flow. And part of the work I'm doing now is basically how to bring in that education so that most people can access it quicker and more reliably and even to recognize it for themselves.
So audience, I wonder where moments are that you've achieved flow. Mm-hmm. There's probably in moments that you don't realize.
Mm-hmm.
Probably having sex.
Yeah.
Cooking dinner.
I was thinking that. Yeah,
no,
for sure.
Cooking is very much one of those sort of creative flow acts. If you're a good cook, if it doesn't seem stressful and you're not trying to cook to impress somebody, you're just cooking to play. You're just cooking to make an experience.
Yeah.
You're throwing stuff together. It's creative. It's you and the food. That's a moment of flow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. My friend said that they get into flow when they're doing the washing up. Something as mundane as that, which you might consider, right? If you're learning something as well, you probably get into moments of flow when you feel that your abilities to match that challenge are stepping up to the plate. And then if it's too hard, it gets frustrating, right? So go easy on yourself.
Cool. So a lot of what you've talked about at moments has sounded like meditation, mm-hmm. and at moments have diverted from that.
Okay, yeah.
So what do you see as the functional interactions between meditation and flow?
The commonalities, I think you can have a practice to try and achieve flow just as much as you can have a practice to achieve meditation. I think the two mental states are different, but they're related to each other. And it could be that meditation is an enabler to help you get into flow. Perhaps it helps almost like a muscle to learn how to be open. Right. And not be constantly editing your thoughts and how to be still in order to allow those, you know, in moments of insights to come to you in the first place. So maybe it helps us kind of be more receptive to even get into this intense state.
I would completely agree with that. Certainly meditation teaches you the discipline of shutting down your edits. It teaches the discipline of being in For some people, flow is a still thing. You're at your desk, you're working. It teaches you the discipline of avoiding the distractions which pull you out of flow and keep you from flow. Mm-hmm. So if you're just sort of ruminating in distraction, you are the opposite of flow.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And you have to clear that space to do it.
Mm-hmm. So the ability to deal with distractions in a more disciplined way, I guess.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the ability to be able to focus your mind and hyper-focus.
Mm-hmm.
In meditation, there are various forms of meditation. So you have a focused attention meditation, which, you know, might be the process that gets you in there.
Yeah.
And then you also have, you can move into, for example, open monitoring, where you're now opening your attention mm-hmm. to all of the things around you.
Mm-hmm.
So that also sounded very similar when you described this process of flow of being able to then be open to the things around you.
Yeah. I also came across this type of Zen meditation. I don't know. There must be loads of different types. But when were you meditate with your eyes half closed? So you're trying to consolidate the inner and the outer world, and that seemed to be quite similar to the process of when you're trying to be simultaneous in the focus and the broad attention. Maybe there's a divergence in other types of meditation when you kind of do that more linearly, maybe, but perhaps it helps you know, the muscles essentially of being able to know what focus is and to know what broadening your attention is. There's a like a U-shaped relationship between flow and stress, for example. Well, when I say stress, I mean more like arousal or stimulation. Mm-hmm. After a certain point, that stimulation is considered stress. So in a way, it's an inverse relationship with stress. So the more stressed out you get, the less likely you are to get into flow.
So there's another reason why meditation may be something that allows you to enter flow more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. If it calms you down and the peacefulness of it all, for sure. Yeah.
So let's turn now to creativity.
Uh-huh.
So some people look at themselves and say like, oh no, I'm not creative.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you're creative, but I'm not creative.
Uh-huh.
What would you say to somebody like that?
I totally disagree with you. I think everybody's creative and you're constantly being creative, whether you realize it or not. And that's why I have to say things like problem solving or, you know, did you say you're the director of innovation or something? That's definitely you being creating something, innovating something. So changing strategy for something, that is being mentally flexible. I think at the moment, you know, the core cognitive element of creativity is to be mentally flexible.
So let's take it down even a few notches from the director of innovation of something.
Yes.
So, you know, any mother? Incredibly
Absolutely.
Creative.
Absolutely.
Most
yes.
people making dinner, if you're trying a new recipe or putting together, you know, new combinations.
Yes. Totally.
Totally creative.
Totally. I actually definitely think that one is very true, especially if you're trying to like, you know, make food for friends who are like ranging from anything between carnivorous to vegan to, you know, whatever else in between, flexitarian. You're like, how am I going to make this happen? Right. So it's meeting a challenge.
Or having an interesting conversation in which you are coming up with novel ideas or responding to somebody in a way that was not necessarily wrote for you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's all creativity, where you're able to sort of visualize situations that may not be the case in this particular reality yet. I think that's using similar sort of muscles in the brain.
So what are these brain muscles that we might be using as we're being creative?
Do you mean neuronally speaking? Yeah. Like, so like we mentioned the default mode network.
So default mode network in this case being a facilitator of creativity or something that helps you kind of search for new ideas or have this internal dream process.
And that dream process is quite interesting in how it could occur, when it could occur, right? So yeah, it could be mind wandering or daydreaming. It could be you going for a walk and measuring out your thoughts. It could be not thinking about it at all, but trusting in the fact that your brain is. It's also percolating down to the lower than the conscious awareness level. It could be during your dreams, you know, and it could be in this state called hypnagogia, which is between sleep and wake.
Which is the most amazing state. Mm-hmm. Tonight, as you go to bed, take a moment and just see what's happening in your brain as you're falling asleep. This is a hard thing to do because when you start to look for sleep, you then can't sleep.
Yeah.
The great Richard Feynman thing.
But when you start
to realize it, you realize that you can be in this incredible state as you're falling asleep where imagery is happening, stories are being told, you can still comprehend them and they make no sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
They are amazing.
Yeah.
And you're going from the state where you have a narrative that's making perfect logical sense. And then all of a sudden, you know, the person is starting to walk up the sky.
Yeah. Or something even more random than that. And you can't even put it into words, right?
Yep. This is the hypnagogic state.
Yeah. And also, I mean, maybe when you're waking up, because, you know, sometimes people go, they reach for their like their notepad as soon as they're waking up because this incredible dream has come to them or whatever, you know. I've woken up with entire tunes in my head when I've just gone straight and I've gone, right, I have to sing it in order to remember it or retain it in some way. I'll hum it to myself, you know, before all goes away. So even if it's not maybe going into sleep, coming out of it, it's had plenty of time to incubate, you know.
So what are some other brain regions that may be at play in creativity?
My supervisor was also looking at the areas looking during insight when you have that eureka moment. Mm-hmm. And it was actually alpha waves in the sort of occipital region where there's mm-hmm. a burst, alpha and gamma, which is quite interesting. And that was like trying to solve a riddle when it's a very obvious situation of having an insight because, you know, there's one answer and you don't have an answer and then you suddenly have an answer. So that's a cool paradigm to be looking at.
The alpha burst. Aha.
I have it, you know? And then like, what do you do with that information?
So this is probably a kind of reaching correlation, but maybe I'm saying this half joking, but so the occipital lobe is responsible for your visual experience. Mm. And most of our alpha waves are generated from our occipital lobe. That is where the generator is. Mm-hmm. But when we think about the idea of, aha, I have an idea, you know, the
ping.
Idea we use is the light bulb goes
totally.
Off.
Totally.
So we are talking about this huge, you know, burst of, you know, momentary burst within your visual cortex.
That's true.
Area.
Wow, I never thought of it that way. Yeah. It's an actual synesthetic.
I don't know.
Oh my
I'm kind
God.
Of saying it jokingly, but.
Maybe. That's why we describe it like that, because it's the experience of it, right?
We have just a hypothesis.
Oh my God. That's really cool. I like that. You know, when people ask me, they're like, oh my God, you're measuring creativity. Don't you think you're like constraining it? I was like, no, man. Like, I'm trying to demystify the process in order to allow you to have a mystical experience still. Do you know what I mean? I think anyway. So that's really cool.
So I'm one of those weird, highly creative scientists, mm-hmm. which is not weird because really all scientists are creative.
Absolutely.
And people would always say, you know, like, oh, science, isn't that so constraining? And as a child, I'd feel like, because I was one of those highly creative things everywhere kind of people. I want to just make stuff in all domains. And I hated the scientific method because it seemed so rigid. Mm-hmm. And adults who were more intelligent than I was and had, you know, wisdom would say, well, the scientific method frees you up to be creative. Mm-hmm. And that thought was always crazy to me until I actually started to bring practice mm-hmm. To multiple domains in which you recognize that you need some sort of construct. And when you have a construct set up, you really can then be extraordinarily free to create within that construct.
Absolutely. Part of it's called creative constraint almost, right? So you could be like, okay, like pretend you have your arm like tied up behind your back. Now go and do something. And you start moving differently because, you know, you now have one arm less or something and you wouldn't have thought about it. And yet it's a constraint, right? So it's a kind of a paradox there already. And then, you know, part of the things I was very interested in is like, how can you have thought frameworks in order to enable creativity, right? Which is still very flexible.
So tell us how you enable creativity.
So the one that I was mentioning to you is a really favorite of mine from Wallace because it's very broad and it allows personal freedom within that. If I just say preparation, I'm just telling you that's what you got to do, but how you prepare is up to you, right? Mm-hmm. And similarly, incubation, you know. There's also other things like design thinking frameworks that, you know, people are taking into companies in order to help with systems and how, you know, organizations are put together, you know. And it's very interesting because communication is a very big part of creativity and also flow. Mm-hmm. and how can you enable that faster or in a more meaningful, or engaging or efficient manner, right? And so I think some of these frameworks are literally structurally related and literally cognitively related at the same time. And so if you can give those like, here's a milestone and here's a milestone, how you get there, essentially up to you. But at least it's a milestone that you recognize. It allows you to work a lot within those constraints, but also be like, huh, okay, I've finished this path, then I've gone into this path, and now I'm into this path. It helps, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think it can be quite easy to get frustrated in the creative path.
And that might be part of it.
It is part of it. And I think one of the things that I've learned as I've gone along is to just be like, expect it. Expect that it's not going to be a linear thing. Expect that there are curveballs. Expect that you're going to go two steps backwards. And you just don't expect it to be like linear. But then I've sort of reduced my frustration at it. After a while, because I'm just like, this is just how it is. And actually, the less time I spend stuck in frustration, the better outcomes I get, or you know, the quicker I get to my place, you know.
So there's another place where mindfulness can be helpful in teaching you when the frustration rises to deal with the sensation of frustration, so you can get back to work. Mm-hmm. I've also found frustration to be very helpful, particularly to prompt me to be creative. So there are some nights where it's just like I have this feeling that I need to make something,
absolutely,
and the frustration of needing to make something is like burning inside of me until I can't not do it.
Okay.
And it often propels me to my best work because it pushes me beyond the boundary. It pushes me beyond the like, okay, I'm just going to sit in my nice little life and do the things I normally do, to be like, I just have to do something now.
Yeah.
And it really frees me. Often like the stuff is physical. Often the stuff is big. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's small. Mm. But it like pushes me beyond any of those sensations of barriers. Because as a creative individual, or even as a not creative individual, because we're all creative individuals.
We are. Yeah.
As a creative individual, there's this often the sensation of barrier because creation is such a weird, novel thing.
Okay.
So, you know, you're sitting in the world as it currently is.
Yeah.
And to change something can often be quite scary, or
it is
to
scary.
Make the steps. Like you've got a blank canvas in front of you, and to actually take the step to make a mark on that canvas can be terrifying because, you know, you don't know what you're going to do. You don't know what's going to come out. You're going to mark this beautiful piece of paper.
And especially it might be wrong.
Yeah.
But maybe there's no wrong.
And so to take that step over the creative threshold, to take that first step of action and to be like, I can do this thing that's not normal. Mm-hmm. I can do this thing that's not status quo. I can do this thing that is changing what's around me.
Yeah.
And it might get really messy and it might be really weird and I can sit and be okay with that.
Yeah. So the courage to sit with it.
To sit with it.
Be okay with uncertainty.
And to just take that step over the threshold.
Mm-hmm. And I think to be like unclear about where you're going to end up is perfectly okay. Until it becomes clearer and clearer. And then maybe you're like, well, actually, it's not that at all. I need to pivot. And that's okay too. I mean, I personally used to consider creativity as a oiling of all the cogs in the consciousness sphere, you know, like of the wheels within that. So it's like this perfect thing where it's all working. If you were to look at it as some sort of mechanical toy where all the cogs and the wheels are turning correctly and together and, you know, harmoniously, I personally feel more happy and fulfilled and more myself when I've been in flow or when I've been creative quite regularly.
Well, the research certainly supports that notion. I mean, you look at the classic Harvard study that says that 46.9% of the time our mind is thinking about something other than what we're currently doing. Mm-hmm. And when we are fully engaged in the moment, we are truly happy.
So
flow is by definition that time when you're truly engaged, when your mind is shut off from all the other, you know, worries about past and future and you're just in the present. So when people talk about, you know, why is mindfulness so amazing? Why is everybody like talking about this mindfulness thing? When you really get mindfulness, that's what it gives you. It gives you this extraordinary ability to be in the moment. And when you're there, it's really happy.
So the presence of it all, which I think is again, another commonality, right? With flow. So.
And mindfulness.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you were talking about how creativity kind of is in some ways the ultimate expression of consciousness.
Yeah, I was calling it the phenotype, where the consciousness might be the genotype, right?
The oiling of the cogs.
Yeah.
So to you, creativity is sort of the ultimate being conscious?
I think the process of it is as if it's a manifestation of consciousness. Right?
Can we roll back and define consciousness for a second?
Yeah, I know that's difficult, right? Isn't it called the hard problem of consciousness for a reason? I think some people consider consciousness to be like visual presence, for example, or, you know, being able to be like detect that that's a lamp, you know, versus it being some amorphous shape that I may or may not be aware of. Or other people might look at consciousness as awareness. Mm-hmm. Others might be like, okay, it's sentience. It's the fact that I have, you know, an opinion about things. Or maybe the ability to plan for the future and reminisce about the past.
Another definition of consciousness is, in it's sort of an old one, the binding principle, the idea that the percepts of your experience, the individual pieces of your visual, audio, sensory experience are coming together at one moment. They are bound together. And that moment when they come together, when you're aware that everything hangs together and exists and works in all of your sensory experience, internal and external, that is the moment of consciousness.
I think that really, really nicely describes how I feel creativity is. So for me, I hold it very highly in esteem in my experience of life is when I have those moments, because I literally feel that that's when everything comes together. So it's helping me, I suppose, experience my existence in a way.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much for showing us how we can experience our existence.
That's what keeps me going.
And you have a company that you've now created to help bring these ideas to people and help them
absolutely
enable these moments more often.
NeuroCreate. Yeah, I guess creativity is in the very name. So I guess my thing was, you know, I would love to be able to help more people achieve these states of flow and also be more creative. And how can we democratize this and scale this? And so we're creating like a digital platform that brings together a symbiotic design between neuroscience, positive psychology, design thinking frameworks, and the abilities of AI in order to create a platform that can enable you to reach these states of flow. And some of it would be using neural data. So we've actually been looking at using the Muse, obviously, which have given us very good correlates for our deep learning model. So that's very cool. So using neurofeedback to help people get into flow. And the other one is like actually like looking at these thought frameworks, right? And how we can create a digital version of these thought frameworks so people can actually go through them themselves and use it whenever they like. So, you know, as I said before, flow means different things to different people. So we have something that's a bit more geared towards creativity to enable you to be more sort of coming up with novel ideas quickly, faster, efficiently, quality ideas, you know, within brainstorming. And the other elements is also like engagement, well-being, and performance to other people. So whether that's within employees and within, you know, for me, it's also about integrating it into your own workflow. So everything that we're doing is trying to create it within your workflow. So that's what
amazing
we're doing.
And where can people learn more about NeuroCreate and you?
So there's a website and it's www.neurocreate.co.uk. Myself, I am kind of over the internet. It depends if you're looking for me as a scientist or as a performer. Type in Shama Rahman and perhaps sitar and you might get the performance angle of things. And neuroscience, you'll get the other side of things.
Well, thank you so much for letting us inside your head today.
I hope you liked what you found.
Absolutely. Very creative, very inspiring.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. So today we learned about flow and creativity. To recap, flow is a state that is very compelling. It's one in which you are fully engaged in the activity that you're doing, where the level of challenge matches your level of ability, and where you're highly creative in thinking flexibly, and you don't have to pay attention to time or distractions. It feels good and rewarding to be in this state. In terms of what's happening in your brain, it looks like it's activating networks that can make connections with ideas faster than a logical decision-making process can. It's a state we've probably all been in, and some activities and conditions lend themselves to flow more easily than others. You can even find flow in your workday. Shama suggests there are some things that you can do beforehand to set the stage for flow, like doing initial preparation, such as researching the topic you're working on and going deep or broadening your thinking and brainstorming. And then making sure you have time set aside to do this without distraction and, of course, without stress. There are many moments in our lives when flow happens, regardless of if you prepare for it or not. To learn more about Shama's company, visit neurocreate.co.uk. I also recommend Googling her and checking out the sitar. If you'd like to see a full video of my conversation with Shama, including an incredibly nerdy debate about the neuroscience of flow versus meditation, you can visit arielgarten.com. That's me, arielgarten.com. And if you're looking for a muse to get brainy about meditation, you can get 15% off at choosemuse.com with the code untangle15. Till next week, when Patricia's back with more Untangle. And to leave you with a little moment of a kind of a flow, Shama and I found a little flow jamming out of nowhere after our conversation. So I have a silly thought. In this process of conversation, we've been in flow, in and out of flow with one another, and we've talked about creativity. Can we sing together and explore creative flow?
Yeah, co-creatively. What would you like to sing?
I can sing anything. It doesn't matter.
Summertime and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and the cotton is high. Boy, your daddy's rich and your ma is good looking. So hush, little baby, don't.